Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Aiken City Council meeting on May 23rd, 2011. Thank you for being with us this evening. And as we go through our agenda, if you'd like to speak on any of the issues, you certainly may do so. We try to hold our comments, if you would, to 5 minutes so that we can move through our agenda. If there's a reason to go longer, if the council has questions or whatever, then certainly it can go a little bit longer. As we begin our meeting, we'll begin with council prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance.
Let us pray. Almighty God, as we put our trust in you, may this body be guided by your Spirit. May each of us seek to know and do your will in serving the people of this great city. Give us courage in times of crisis and hard decision-making. Give us integrity in our dealings. Bless our nation, our president, our state and her leaders, and the city staff who so ably serve our residents. Protect and keep safe our defenders of freedom and those who protect the citizens of Aiken. We ask these things in your name. Amen.
Amen.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are there any additions or deletions necessary to our agenda this evening? I have one. We have a gentleman that would like to speak at the end of the meeting, Claude O'Donovan, address council just for a very short comment or two. So we just add that at the end under petitions and requests. That would be number two, item number two, under petitions and requests. Do we have a motion and a second to approve the agenda then?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Under the minutes, consideration of the minutes of the regular meeting of May 9th, 2011. Any discussion? If not, do we have a motion and a second?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Second.
Oh, we have a second. Okay. All hands. Show of hands, please. All in favor? Approval? Passes unanimously. Item two, presentations. A presentation by Laura DeSano, USC Aiken, a business center. Mr. Pierce, please.
Well, Mayor, thank you very much. Ms. DeSano is with us here tonight, and she is with the Small Business Development Center of South Carolina. USC Aiken is their area office. She wanted to make a presentation to council today, and I told her when she made that request that was very timely because, of course, in the strategic plan for the city of Aiken, an outreach to our small business community is contained very prominently in that. And I think Laura has some good ideas of how small business can improve their operations. So, Laura, without any further ado, could you come talk to us, please?
Thank you very much. Good evening, Mayor and council members. Can you hear me? Okay. Okay, great. First of all, I must have really wanted to be here today because there was a snafu in my calendar. So I was up at 5 o'clock this morning for what I thought was a 7 o'clock in the morning meeting. And a very nice custodian in the building and I hunted around. So I've waited 12 hours to be here, so hopefully... Okay. Richard mentioned that I had asked him about coming to a meeting, and I really had three objectives. One, first of all, is to introduce myself. I provided you with some information on my background. I worked in a Fortune 100 company and have done a lot of work with businesses ranging from zero up to about 50 million. I've provided some information on the center, on the center's performance and goals for 2011, and just wanted to announce that I was recently appointed the new lead at USC Aiken. I have also brought in another seasoned businessman and entrepreneur, Bob Clark, who joined me 2 weeks ago. The second purpose is really to work collaboratively in the marketplace with economic development, Dave Jamison and the Chamber, Score Leadership, Down downtown development, city government, and the university. And thirdly, to offer a personal thank you for your past and continued support of our SBDC and share its value to our state and community. I know these are challenging times, and we are very grateful for your support of us, and through that support, our small business community is supported as well. As many of you know, the mission of the SBDC is to enhance South Carolina's economic development by helping entrepreneurs grow successful businesses, as measured by clients served, both new clients and long-term clients, the hours that we counsel, working with existing businesses and startups. We conduct many useful seminars on taxes, such things as QuickBooks, business planning, financial planning, marketing, strategic planning, loan packaging, licensing, and certification. In 2010, approximately 60% of our clients were existing businesses, many coming to SBDC to figure out how to manage through the recession. Things that worked before no longer worked, and they needed help to navigate and survive. 40% of our clients were entrepreneurs who were considering startups, and we guided them through the process, planning, and launch. We acquired 100 new clients, 23 of them became long-term clients, and represent anything from nuclear cluster companies to cottage industries, manufacturing and retail, to technology and science-based businesses and professional practices. We partnered with economic development and are working right now with a biopharmaceutical company already established that has quadrupled revenues in 3 years and currently hires every single chemistry grad out of USC Aiken. We conducted 9 workshops delivered to 150 clients. In 2011, we expect to deliver $2 million in capital formation. One client may receive a $2 million loan this year, which we've been working on for 10 months. But many others are foraying back into banking centers, according to my local banking contacts, to apply for financing, which is a good sign. We expect 140 new clients this year. 22 will be long-term. We hope to create 56 new jobs through 10 startups. We will hold 9 seminars and train 200. Four of those seminars will be completed by June, and will promote government certification and nuclear cluster subcontractors, which is a very important area. And this will be in both the nuclear and non-nuclear areas. The funding and return on investment, the SBA, SBDC provides $1.4 million through a cooperative agreement. It requires a one-to-one match of state and local funds. 90% of the funds go directly to field delivery of services to small businesses. And for every dollar invested by the state, the SBDC generates $5.85 in federal and local funding. The state match funds ensure that we can draw down on federal funding. I'm not going to bore you by going through every detail, you know, in the packet. There's a lot of information that speaks to the impact of the SBDC statewide. They brought in about $8 million or helped to form $8 million of capital. There was 2,260 new jobs created, $67 million in annual wages, there were 68 new business starts, and the government contract awards were $130 million. So I think they're doing a good job. I really wanted to just come and say hello. I wanted you to know that I'm available. I ask that you call upon me if I can assist you in any way, and I want to thank you for all that you do for us. Thanks.
Gee, thank you, Laura. What a workload and what you've already accomplished. It's great. Well, thank you so much.
Mayor, unless there's any objection from council, our plan was to take the information that Ms. DeSano brought tonight and then share that with the folks that participated in the Small Business Forum, and then we'll find other ways to make the information available since it is available at no cost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks again for being with us, and the job well done. And the future looks bright, too, there. Under old business.
No items.
There is none. New business. First item, approval of proposed improvements to the intersection at Gregg Highway and the Robert M. Bell Parkway. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. We have a resolution entitled, A Resolution Authorizing the City of Aiken to Approve the SCDOT Project on Gregg Highway at Robert M. Bell Parkway. Several weeks ago, I had provided information to council that we had received notification from SCDOT that they were proceeding with this project. And as council is familiar with the SCDOT projects that are within the city limits, SCDOT obtains approval from us for those projects. Larry Morris is here and has some details on that. The one item that would particularly be of council's interest, I would think, is we do have to relocate about 600 feet of water line to get it out of the way of the improvements. But actually, that may prove to be helpful to us in the sizing of the line anyway. So it's more of a catalyst to us to do the work. It's not extra work that we would not have to do. So for council's consideration is just the approval of that project and allowing you, Mayor, to sign off on that as you have so many other SCDOT projects in the past.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to just ask Larry. Where's Larry?
He's here.
Just give us your thoughts on it, Larry. Any problems, any potential problems, everything going smoothly? When will it be finished and all those things?
No potential problems to us, Mayor. This is going to help realign a very dangerous intersection.
It is dangerous.
Right there with Gregg Highway and Robert M. Bell Parkway.
Mm-hmm.
We're very pleased that the DOT is working with us to do this. I am not sure on their timetable. Until they get everything signed off by us, they will not finish their plans and go to bid. The plan that you see there is fairly complex, but it's one that once they do get it going, that should be fairly rapid to do. We will have to move our water line before they can get going and get all of the grading and excavation done. But as Mr. Pierce indicated, that was something we were going to be needing to do anyway. It was a very old line, and it will give us a chance to upgrade that line and upgrade that service down near the rehab center.
Good. Okay. Any comments?
Yeah. Larry, the reason this is being done is because that's a dangerous intersection?
Very dangerous intersection. I've had four children now go to USCA, and all of them would avoid that intersection like the plague, if you'll pardon the expression. They would normally go around that area. I know whenever I've driven it, going to events at the Convocation Center, and watch people trying to get out there. It is a Robert M. Bell is fairly high speed, and you're pulling out from a dead stop, and there's just no room right there. So this will help realign that and give additional sight distance to the Gregg Highway folks.
And are we going to work with the USCA? Because this could have an impact, obviously, on events, that, depending on how they deal with traffic as they do the improvement.
We'll be, once council has approved this, we'll be notifying Mike Jarrah, who is the engineer with USCA, just so he knows about it. I do not know if SCDOT has approached them or not, just out of courtesy letting them know what was happening.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think this is such a needed thing. I used to travel that road when I worked down there, and that's a very, very, very dangerous road. I can remember the first fatality when they first opened that road up. And I think this is something that's long overdue. I think we need to do what we can do to help out.
Very good. Okay. Do we have a motion and second?
I so move, Mr. Mayor.
All right.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Second. Any other discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay. Passes unanimously. Item two, auditing firm selection. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. Every 3 years or so, we come before council as a result of our request for qualifications and bids by various auditing firms to conduct the annual audit that is required by state law. Our assistant city manager worked with our finance department director and received those proposals. The apparent low bidder was Thompson Price Scott Adams and Company. They bid $88,500 for 3 years. The next lowest bid was Elliott Davis at $102,625. Upon further investigation by our finance department director, though, it appears that Elliott Davis is the lowest responsible bidder under the provisions of our city procurement code for a number of reasons that I included in the memo that I shared with council, and of course that we put on the website, and it is available in the foyer for anyone who would like to have it. In particular, the software program, they don't have a sufficient software program to meet the needed Government Accounting Standard Board 34 conversions. They haven't demonstrated proficiency in the areas of practice needed to meet the Government Finance Officers Association requirements. You know, that's an award that we've won for the last 18 years. And then there were other concerns that, you know, certainly if council has questions, I think Ms. Abney is certainly here and she'd be happy to address those with you. But her recommendation and the assistant city manager's recommendation, in which I concur, is to go with Elliott Davis for our annual auditing for the next 3 years, and that would be for council approval.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Comments? Do we have a motion and a second?
So moved, Mr. Mayor. Okay.
I'll second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Now comments, if there are any. Okay. If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously.
Thank you. We'll proceed to notify Elliott Davis of that.
Okay. Item 3, resolution to approve assignment of assets for the FBO, the airport lease, the FBO airport lease. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The resolution is entitled, a resolution authorizing the mayor to execute any documents to facilitate refinancing of the lease agreement and fixed-based operator agreement for the Aiken Municipal Airport. Aiken Aviation Enterprises Incorporated is your fixed-based operator. We signed a lease with them. Let's see, that was back in 1999, and that was approved by council. In the business operation, the fixed base operator did have a loan. They would care to refinance the loan at this time. And I, on your desk when you came tonight is actually the assignment of that lease as collateral. And the FBO has come to us because under that 1999 lease agreement, any assignment requires the approval of council. This isn't changing the terms of the lease. It's not altering that in any way. It's just a chance for him to refinance and get a better rate from the bank. And Mike Laver is here in the audience today, who is the principal in Aiken Aviation Enterprises and certainly could answer any questions that council may have. But for approval tonight is just the adoption of the resolution to authorize us to consent to the assignment of that collateral for the refinancing purposes.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second?
Second, Mr. Chair.
We have a second. Any discussion?
I have one question. It goes back to when we had our zero budget based. Now, this is the operation versus any of the capital improvements, because I think there's a fund set up where we sell the city property and then that money goes for improvements out there from the business park.
Right. Now, that would not place that as a lien against any of that money or any of the building access. It's actually the lease agreement itself.
Itself, okay. Right. So it has nothing to do with the capital work that goes on.
No, it should not. Okay. Should not include that.
Thank you.
Because that would be public.
Public money.
Property, right.
Any other comments? I'd just like to say to Mike, appreciate all the work you've done so far. Many years you've been out there supporting the airport.
And I appreciate the support of the city, too.
It's looking better all the time.
Yeah, and Mayor, I would like to echo the fact that very, very soon after becoming your next city manager, Mike and I had a very interesting tour of the FBO's lease space as well as the airport itself, and we've discussed some plans for the future at the airport, and I think Mike's heart is in the right place and certainly is very proud of Aiken and happy to show it off to the visitors who come through, and he's kind of a airborne ambassador, if you will, at the airport, and selling Aiken quite often, and I appreciate it.
Mr. Mayor, as a user,
airport user, I should say.
That's good clarification.
No, and, you know, I fly around to a lot of different airports in the state and out of state, and I can honestly say I'm proud to be based at Aiken. It's got a great facility, and the people are fantastic.
Thank you, Steve.
Mr. Mayor, if Mike will come forward, I've got a couple questions to ask if you don't.
Okay.
Mike.
Mike. Would you come up to the mic? Now you're going to get grilled here.
No, you won't. This is all good stuff. Mike, as you know, when we built the airport, the thought was that the conference room that we had would get good use.
Yeah.
How is the use? Is it used heavily? What's the flow of traffic in and out of that facility?
The conference room, I would think, would probably use once a week, maybe okay. twice a week. We've been fairly careful. We restrict the use of the conference center to aviation-related business or business development in the area. Mm-hmm. We do get a lot of people who just arbitrarily want to use it, and they don't really have business in the Aiken area. So we've been fairly careful how we do that. But the conference room has been used, and it still looked as good as the day it was built, and it's been very helpful.
Well, that was what I was curious about. I haven't been out there in a while, and I just wanted to know about the appearance and the usage of that facility because of our pushing to get this facility built and the use of that that room.
The facility itself, we get so many comments about the facility. It's one of the best. It's the best in the state and one of the best in the country, I think. And people are so surprised when they fly in that Aiken has such a beautiful facility.
I think it had an impact too, don't you, Mike, when we met with the FAA. We were talking about the localizer, the glide slope installation, and I think when they came and saw the operation, they understood exactly why we were seeking that equipment.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And if I may just take a few minutes.
Sure.
The Masters this year was quite incredible. We had jets from as far as France. We had an airplane
wow.
that ended up at the airport from Paris. There was people on board, and I've witnessed over the years as Aiken Airport progresses. We have really got into a league now of accepting and having the facility for large business jets. And just in the last 12 months, I've just seen that we've gone to the next level. So the potential for the Aiken Airport is great from this point on.
Okay.
Very and I good. Think everyone needs to be proud of the airport here in Aiken. And the city has done a wonderful job in supporting us at the airport. It's been overwhelming.
Very good.
It's good to hear.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And we thank Larry, too, right, Mike?
Absolutely.
Who works with you. Okay.
Did you want to vote?
I'm sorry.
Did you get a vote?
No, not yet.
No. We have a motion and a second. Show of hands, please. All in favor? Passage unanimous. Item 4 is approval of a resolution for parking lot agreement with the First Baptist Church. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you again. This is a resolution. It's entitled a resolution authorizing approval of an agreement for a joint use parking lot. Council will recall that in the downtown area immediately behind Moonbeans and several downtown businesses, we entered into several joint parking lot use agreements behind the former Eulalie Sally real estate firm, and their current name escapes me at this point in time. But those whole parking lots back there didn't just happen. Wade Brody worked very hard and worked with the local merchants, and that was some of the first work I did for you as the staff attorney for the city of Aiken, putting those agreements together so that what was abandoned property and really just sand that was growing weeds has turned into the parking lots that we have now, where we've been able to showcase certain aspects of the green infrastructure project. And Wade came to me several months ago with a proposal for a joint use parking lot immediately adjacent to the Center for African American History, Art, and Culture. We've had some back and forth. City staff has reviewed the agreement, and the trustees have propose the agreement that you have in your packet here tonight. Wade is here and can provide some more background for the benefits that this lot would provide. But that's what's for consideration tonight, is the approval of that agreement for the city to enter into with First Baptist Church.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second?
So moved, Mr. Mayor, that we adopt this for approval, authorizing the mayor to sign this agreement for a parking lot off of York Street.
Okay. Beverly, did you second?
I'll second it.
Yeah. Second. Okay. Any discussion?
One thing, Mr. Mayor. There is some work that the Culture Center has going on there as now. There's some drainage issues around the building itself yet to be done. And I'm not that familiar with Mr. Wade may be, but I would think that the Culture Center would need to get their part done, you know, before we do this. And so what I think we need to do as a suggestion is look at getting what needs to be done by each of the parties, right, and then let Mr. Morris put a price tag on it and come back to us. Because there's a dividing line, I think, there between the First Baptist Church and the Culture Center. And part of that is would be on the within the Culture Center area. So I'd like to see us get a little more information and cost on it before we move forward.
And it may help, Council, Mayor. Paragraph 2 of the agreement actually sets forth the city responsibilities under the agreement. Mm-hmm. It's 2A, B, C, D, E. It would be the actual work. But, of course, Larry is here and could speak to the conversations he's had with Wade. And Wade is here as well to provide any clarification that might be helpful.
Okay. Let's see what kind of clarification we get now from Wade or Larry. Wade, can you add something to this discussion?
While they're coming forward, are you saying that the Culture Center has contributed to the drainage problem? Not sure.
No, there used to be a parking lot with bumper logs and so forth there, and you'd see the bumper logs piled up. When they started working on the Culture Center, for some reason that land through there is the highest point. It's like it was filled in as a parking lot. And so when they dug down to get to the lower level of the foundations for the Culture Center, there's an opening there, I guess, 6 or 8 feet wide, Wade.
Correct.
And about 3 or 4 feet deep along there that never has had the permanent drainage put in the rock and everything to drain the foundation of the Culture Center. Because the place was a parking lot. You can see the bumper logs and the stripes on that. So I think we need to be sure that we get the work segmented right and get it all done properly. It's a little more than just the parking lot's not the biggest issue. It's adjacent to the parking lot, and it may be on part of the property. I don't know.
Okay.
Wade Brody, 422 York Street. Reggie is correct, and it is a drainage problem in that area, and we hope the city will work with us in solving that. When that parking lot was put in, it was raised,
yeah,
probably 2-3 feet above the existing ground level. Another part of the problem is the city storm sewer at that location. Is almost up to road grade level. So there's, without some work, there's no way that we could get the water from the building into the city storm sewer.
Right.
Well, that's the basic problem there, as I said.
Yep.
You want to address, Larry, you're familiar with this. You want to address the work that needs to be done and the amount of that work, or in any way you want to address it?
Wade and I have been looking at this for a couple of years now, and the storm drain that we put in across the front when we were doing our improvements to the street, removing the old pavement from the gas station, putting curb and gutter and trees and lighting there, we had to go all the way down to the corner of Richland and York.
Mm-hmm.
That storm sewer there is SCDOT. It's only about 2 feet deep. So as Wade says, we are right at the top of the ground in front of the Cultural Center. To make that work, we're going to have to put in an oversized pipe, about a 12-inch diameter pipe, and run it almost flat from the edge of York Street back to try to pick up the drainage from the African American Cultural Center. then we would be able to come in and rework the parking lot. If you notice on page 2 of the agreement, they are asking that we landscape the area, that we install lighting. They don't say anything about the paving of the lot, but I feel that we would end up needing to pave the lot. If we're doing all of this work, you know, we don't need to go halfway on it. We do need to go ahead and renew the entire lot. I put some rough numbers to it. We're from 40 to 50,000 by the time we get our lights in, we get the drainage in, we get the lot repaved, and that's a real rough estimate right now. As Mr. Ebner says, I need to get into it a little deeper once we know. If you notice on item E, 2E, city will work with the church properties committee to develop plans. Without plans, again, I'm taking a guess for you. I don't see that we would be over that, but I do see that it is not something we can go out and spend $1,000 on and make it look nice. If we want it to match what we have on the other side, we are going to have to spend some money over on that side.
You're talking about Heritage Park?
Yes, sir. Thank you. The lights alone for that are around $1,100 each, and these are the standard 14-footers that we use, our old Aiken lights. So you can imagine just four lights over there, which may cover it and may not, just due to the way the parking lot has a different shape in the middle of it. It has a small turn. So we may need about six lights. There's almost $10,000 just in the lights alone, and that doesn't get me any wiring or conduit or anything else to install them. So it is an expensive proposition, and one that, you know, I would be glad once we can get a development plan worked out with the church building committee there, that we'd be glad to put some numbers and bring it back to council if you so desire.
Is for the stormwater work, and it's really on both sides of the building there, because Larry and I talked about it when we did Heritage Park. Is the stormwater fees, would that cover, is that legitimate to use that? Because this is a stormwater problem, and the area does pay stormwater fees.
It is appropriate.
But it's something I think we could look at for part of the financing that's already
Absolutely.
There versus a budget item. So I think if we put this together, it could come out very well.
Yes, sir.
On that. But I think we need to get the pieces together, because it's a little more than just the parking lot.
We do have.
It is, and I think the agreement sets that forth. You know, certainly if the agreement is to be approved tonight, before we would proceed for any work, we can bring the plan back to council for approval, and we can make that part of the motion tonight on the acceptance of the agreement, so that we wouldn't start spending taxpayer money until we actually had a plan in place and a timeline and a design, so we knew exactly what commitment we had made.
And I think that's important to do, because I think you're going to get a lot of help from a lot of different organizations there, because there's actually another church on the corner, and
that's right.
I think it's Brothers and Sisters or Sisters and Brothers.
Right. I'm not sure that they're still there. Are they still there?
Yeah, they were there tonight. I drove by in their cars. Sir, so, but I think get the plan together, and then we could rule on that once you get it all together.
There's plans for them to move.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think they are going to move, Mr. Ebner, but they are there now. You're right.
Yeah, that's church property also. That building belongs to the church, and
that's right.
It is in dire need of repair.
And Mr. Ebner, we would need to involve our planning department in that to make sure that the design of the parking lot did meet our standards.
Yeah. And I would think you all talk to the church, and maybe Mr. Brodekin, what are they going to do with the house? Because I know a couple of years ago, my wife was working there, and they were talking about removing it or something, but it's in a historical district or something.
The intent is, if Brothers and Sisters move, when they move, to tear that building down.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. So we might incorporate that and just let's do one plan and not double spend as we go through.
It's in bad repair. Just a couple other comments. There is no off-street parking, no on-street parking at this location. Other than the church, Brothers and Sisters are the primary user of that lot. But I foresee, as Heritage Park is developed and people want to come into town, tourists, and want to get out and stretch their legs, they're not going to know that we've got a parking lot on the east side of the Heritage Park. As you recall, we negotiated with Wesley United Church brought that to the city, and they donated 20 feet, and we used 20 feet of the park to put in 20 parking spaces over there. But it's kind of off the beaten path if you're coming in on 302. You know, it's easy to turn right in, but coming in number one, I think the church parking lot will be used for visiting Heritage Park.
On the east side, didn't we make that green parking space clear?
What was it?
Sir? Was that pervious parking on the east side of Heritage Park?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is brick on that east side. And we did go ahead and run the area where the crepe myrtles are planted is run lower than the other area, so it acts as a small detention area. And we did put pipes available to that side of the African American Center to hook up to our system.
I think it would be fine for the council if we get the whole plan together and incorporate the future tearing down of this particular building too into it, so we don't do part of the stormwater and have to come back and do some more later. So yeah, I think we pass it and then come back with a plan to council once it goes through the appropriate groups.
I would prefer that we not include that building in the proposal, primarily because the church is not going to throw those people out on the street. And this has been under discussion for years now. So we may never get around to approving the park if we wait till that building is moved.
Let me rephrase it then. Let's be sure that we plan for the drainage of that building in the future.
Right, okay. All right. Then council agree we'll approve this on the basis that no money spent until the details come back to us.
We'll bring the plan back to council for
approval. Let me just make a comment. I'm having a hard time seeing the public benefit of this, and maybe I need some help, but we're being asked to spend thousands of dollars on a piece of private property. We're being locked into an agreement for 10 years, no out until after 10 years, and then the option is an automatic 5-year extension, or it can be canceled with a 30 days notice. We're talking about spending money for irrigation, a permanent commitment on planting, it appears to me as I read this, but I'm not an attorney. Lighting and other improvements, plus the draining. I agree with Councilman Ebner. I sure would like to have a good sense of our total cost on this project before we approve anything. I'm not sure that I can support passing it. I'm not against the idea, but I just would like to know the cost, and I'd like to have a better sense of the public benefit. The cultural center is not yet in a position to have crowds show up. They're working there, and I wonder if we're not premature in setting up this parking lot. But
right.
I'd be more comfortable knowing what the cost is involved before I approve it.
Well, now, we don't have to pass anything. We can continue this until we get the information. I don't know what we gain by passing a resolution at this point when we're not going to do anything anyway until we get the plan and the cost.
If you pass the agreement, Mayor, you would have a legal basis to go forward with the planning, and that would necessarily involve some... Where did Larry go? Oh, there you go.
Okay.
You were sitting over there, right? Okay, I'm just checking on. But anyway, with the agreement gives us the basis to formulate the plan and go forward to do with the cost estimates, because there'll be a little bit of expense involved in that. Yeah.
Okay, well, if we need to do it then. And
well, I've heard that before. You got to pass the bill to see what's in it. That doesn't make any sense. You know, you're saying we got to approve it before we can go to plan to figure out how much money we're going to spend.
What I'm saying is that the agreement provides a legal basis for us to spend public funds on developing a plan for the lot.
Well, then let's find out how much public funds we need to spend for planning, and we can...
Why don't we pass a motion just saying... you know, let Larry invest what manpower he needs to come back with a reasonable cost proposal to cover paragraph 2.
Certainly can do that. Certainly can do that.
Sure.
All right, is that a motion?
I just have...
You just made it. We already have our motions, didn't
we? Yeah.
Yes, we do. But I do have a question about the purpose of the whole thing, and that is that the parking that we're trying to make here is not necessarily for the cultural center, but basically for the heritage park that's next door. Is that not correct? and for the church to use on Sundays. And so it's a joint effort and a shared purpose. And I think, I don't want to confuse this as being part of the cultural center. I was thinking that it was, when I read this, I basically thought it was for the park that does not have off-street parking there, and maybe in some way help the church not have to incur the traffic that they might incur with visitors coming in and using the church parking lot and walking across the street to the park. It's what I thought when I read it. And so now I don't know that it's our park, and it's for our parking purposes and for the church to use on Sundays and maybe Wednesday nights or whenever they need to use it.
Ms. Glavin, I thank you for that clarification, because immediately when you mentioned the CAAHAC, flags go up. So I thank you, and perhaps we can move this forward to benefit First Baptist Church and to benefit the Heritage Park. So I thank you for clarifying that.
My comments had nothing negative about the Cultural Center. It's just strictly the idea that I've been consistent since I've been on council of spending public money for private purposes, even though there might be a good public intent.
I think the Heritage Park.
I certainly would want to know how much we're being asked to spend.
The Heritage Park is a public park. Is that right? Okay.
But the property that we're talking about improving is private property.
It is. Yeah.
Okay, what's council's?
Well, I think we have a motion that we have to.
We do.
There's a motion.
We did. But we did say that we wanted to not spend any money. What was the motion? Let's state the motion again, because I'm not sure that we.
The motion is to adopt a resolution authorizing the mayor to sign an agreement for a parking lot off York Street to benefit the City Heritage Park and the CAAHAC. And then that's when Mr. Ebner brought up the drainage area. But it is to sign an agreement. There's no funds attached to this.
And that's what we said, that we didn't want any funds attached to it. I'll just make sure that that's the case, until it comes back to us with the detailed plan and cost. Okay, we've got a motion and a second then on that.
But we're accepting the agreement, and the agreement calls for us to make those improvements on paragraph 2. I'm kind of confused. I need some clarification.
Somehow or another, we're committing ourselves, even though we don't say we have any money, but if the bill comes in later, we're obligated by voting for the agreement. What I say is I think we should modify the motion or vote it down and then just specifically authorize Public Works to do some study and give us some realistic figures on what we're talking about, and then readdress it at a later date.
I agree.
That sounds good. All right. Would you amend your motion, Leslie, to that point?
What is being proposed that I amend it to?
I think Mr. Homoki is asking that the agreement not be passed until there is a more definite estimate as to what this is going to cost the city. In order for that to go to council, you would need to agree to amend your motion to allow that to occur. I'm not saying you have to. I'm just saying that's in order to adopt Mr. Homoki's proposal, that's what you would need to do. Or you can withdraw the motion that you've already made.
The fact is, the parking lot as it is now will be used right now, can it? The parking by the church. Or those folks that come in for the building next door. So it's just the fact that the work needs to be done on the drainage.
Stormwater.
And
but what I'm hearing is that the draining issues actually need to be done.
They need to be done anyway.
Right, anyway. No matter what's next door, no matter who parks there.
Not necessarily before. The church can use it.
Well, they're using it now, but...
The paragraph 2 just says that we give them permission to use it.
Right.
Under the proposed agreement, church would have the right to use the lots for Sunday services.
I withdraw the motion, and I hope First Baptist come before the group to make the request that can get approved, but I withdraw the motion.
Mm-hmm. And I will withdraw the second pending the outcome of the study on what it's going to cost the city to make the repairs, and that way we can have figures in front of us when we
thank you.
We voted in.
Do we have another motion then?
Well,
another motion.
I move we authorize Public Works to come up with some cost estimates to achieve the work as outlined in paragraph 2 of the tentative agreement. Is that about right?
Yes. Proposed agreement?
Proposed agreement.
I'll second that.
Second. Okay. 3 seconds.
Okay. But in the meantime, the church can continue to use the lot, which they've been doing.
Yeah. They own.
Their property.
They own.
Their property.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay, passes. Opposed? Okay, passes 6-1. Item 5, resolution to accept deeds to Spencer Drive properties. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a resolution authorizing acceptance of 5 deeds of dedication for roadways contiguous to Spencer Drive from Hallam LLC and Adiz LLC. The roadways are Amity Lane, Bennington Lane, Hillsborough Lane, New Haven Lane, Pornofino Lane. In addition, the companies are asking us to accept the water system, sewer system, stormwater, and stormwater detention infrastructure. Larry Morris has reviewed the deeds, as has our staff attorney, Ben Moore, and he is recommending that we do accept these roads and these systems. So for council approval is adoption of the resolution to accept those deeds.
Okay. Do we have a motion and second?
Mr. Mayor, I move that we adopt the resolutions accepting deeds of the dedication of the streets that's listed in our memorandum.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. And I talked to Larry on a couple of these items. Right next to this on Spencer, there's a dump that's being created there, and it's obviously from the construction material. And I don't know if that's a common area, if that's part of the development, but it's beginning to collect asphalt, concrete, rocks, and stuff. And I don't know if this is common area or how do we get it cleaned up.
If I can address Mr. Ebner's question there. That area right there is partially common area, and I think some of it actually spills on to the Spencer Drive right-of-way where you're talking about. What we have to try to do is catch who's doing it and force them to clean it up. It is illegal dumping, and it's not something that we condone.
Do we need to get our city inspector to go by there, or do I need to request that? That's a simple thing to do, but it's collecting more stuff because somebody saw one load, now it's got, I think, 4 loads of dirt there.
We'll be working with public safety on that.
All right, thank you. The other thing that I asked Mr. Morris about, at one of the, and I don't know if they're detention or retention ponds, but it's got about an 80-foot slope, maybe as much as 90-foot slope. And I was concerned about if there was a slope analysis done, because we had a cave-in behind Walmart, which is a little over a mile away. And I guess my concern there is there a liability from the city, because if this slides down the hill, it's going to fill in the pond. Well, that isn't a real problem. You clean it out. But there's houses about 15 feet away from this. And I just want to be sure if there's any indemnification we need to write in here, if this does slide off the hill, that we would not be liable for housing or any damages to people.
Typically, once the city accepts responsibility for this stuff, once they receive the deeds for these properties, the city accepts the responsibility for what's going on with them. And the property owners wouldn't deed it to us without passing that along.
All right. So
Larry has to be satisfied that he's comfortable with the design of the structure and that sort of thing.
All right. But if it does happen to slide downhill and some houses are damaged or whatever, who pays for that damage?
It's going to be a long, drawn-out process. Lots of lawyers will make lots of money. Insurance companies will be involved.
Is there any way to protect the city?
Are we accepting the pond?
We are accepting the detention pond. There are some major differences between this and the pond behind Walmart. The pond behind Walmart was taking heavy construction traffic over there and was on a one-to-one slope. This pond is not on a one-to-one slope and is not taking traffic. It's not in a traffic area, so there's no vibration to speak of. This one has stood for several years now, whereas the pond in Walmart failed within months of the slope being there. So we feel that it is stable at this time. To answer Mr. Ebner's question, no, we do not have a slope stability analysis done by an engineer on it. We did observe the construction of it. It was properly compacted when the fill was put in.
You do own lots of retention ponds, though.
Not too many of them with 80 or 90-foot deep holes in the ground. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments? Got a motion and second. Show of hands. All in favor? Okay. Passage unanimously. Okay. Item 6, consideration of a proposed schedule to review city council districts. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. We also, as part of this action item, have a resolution relating to the establishment of city council member district boundaries following receipt of the 2010 federal census. After the decennial census, we do conduct a review to determine whether our current districting plan for city council seats will hold muster. The last time we took a look at this was after the 2000 census, and in 2002 there was a referendum and then also a redistricting where we retained the 421 program we have today. Back then and a couple of times before, Jim Holly has assisted us with the redistricting process. He's here tonight and can provide you with the thoughts behind not only the resolution but the proposed schedule that we have for our redistricting review this time. We have the information session tonight. We are proposing a public hearing to be held next Thursday, June 2nd at 6 p.m. in this room. And we do have Bobby Bowers from the Statistics Division of the Budget and Control Board offices in Columbia who has a presentation for us to provide public information. Based on the information we receive at that public hearing, it would be possible for us to develop an ordinance for an additional public hearing at your June 13 council meeting. Then that would also, depending on the results at first reading, provide an opportunity for a second reading and an additional public hearing on June 27th. Any ordinance that was passed by City Council could then be submitted to the United States Department of Justice for clearance in July. Typically, that's a 60-day process, and we would get their responses back after Labor Day. That would provide us an opportunity, if it's necessary, to advertise any referendum election that might be necessary, and then we could possibly, just again depending on the process we're about to go through, proceed with the general election on November 8th. And if there's any referendum that's necessary for a redistricting plan, that could also be on the ballot at the same time. Jim Holly is here. I believe he's making his way forward. Yes, he's making his way forward and has a presentation for us to provide the basis for this proposed schedule, as well as the resolution, the proposed process we would go through to examine our city council districts. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, Council, Richard did an excellent job reviewing the status of where we are. You do have a proposed schedule. Obviously, over time, that schedule can change depending on development, but a key first step in any redistricting effort is to get public input. And as City Manager indicated, that is tentatively been scheduled for next Thursday, I believe it is, and Mr. Bowers has that on a schedule to attend and provide an initial overview. I don't know that I really have anything more to add to what the City Manager stated. Of course, Mr. Bowers and his staff at the Office of Research and Statistics will be providing census information, demographic information, expertise. And to the extent council desires me to, of course, I'll be providing legal advice on that, as I've done in the past. Richard and I consulted over the last 2 weeks about the schedule and believe that the one proposed is reasonable to get started on this process. So I'll be glad to answer any questions council may have.
I'm looking at the schedule here, and it says the DOJ clearance or pre-clearance wouldn't be getting here till approximately the first or second week in September. I believe we've got an election coming in. How does that affect the party primaries?
Yes.
I'm sure that's of concern to Mr.
Yes.
Dewar.
Based on the preliminary discussions we've had so far, it's our hope and expectation that the pre-clearance action by the Department of Justice would not affect the current election schedule. That's going to depend to some extent on what route council chooses. That is, whether to retain the 421 plan, the current plan, and simply redistrict the boundaries of those four districts to comply with the constitutional requirement of one person, one vote. In other words, the four districts need to have relatively equal populations, or because of the impact of the Voting Rights Act, which affords some protection of minority voting groups, whether because of the census, the council have to, instead of considering the 421 as a solution, look to changing the method of election. For example, and this is just an example, to have six election districts rather than four. If it goes the second route of having six election districts, the election could still proceed. And then the question, assuming that the Justice Department does not object, and then the next step would be drafting election districts, whether they're four or whether they're six, after City Council makes that decision. But under either scenario, the objective, as I understand it, is to preserve the current election schedule and only change that if the Justice Department, because of its comments and reviewing whatever is submitted, indicates that they would require a different schedule.
Jim, that's sure. Exactly what right. We did with the 2000 right. census results.
Right.
The 2001 election proceeded, and then it was 2002 when we proceeded right. with the redistrict.
That's correct. And just to remind council, back in after the last census, council initially decided to do a referendum on whether to change from a 421 to a 511 plan. Having that election had to be pre-cleared by the Justice Department. The election was then had. The referendum was unsuccessful. So council then went back to the drawing boards and revised the 421 plan, the four districts, submitted that to Justice, and then had its first election under that plan in 2003, as I recall, on the same schedule. So the approach this cycle would be, to the extent possible, keep the current election cycles in place and only change those if it becomes necessary because of the actions of the Department of Justice in pre-clearing whatever is submitted to them. You could submit a 421 plan with revising the four existing districts, indicating that you're going to stay on the current election schedule implemented with those districts to be implemented in 2013. Or instead, if council chooses to submit a referendum to the people to change the method of election, to change the number of districts, then that would be submitted to the Department of Justice with an indication that it would be implemented, again, the new plan in 2013. If the Justice Department indicated that schedule was not acceptable, then council would have to look at a different schedule to implement whatever plan it decides to put in place. I hope that's sufficiently clear.
Yeah, I'm still a little confused. If we don't have something in the mail to the Justice Department by June 1st, it's my understanding that we cannot redistrict based on the new census figures for the 2010 election.
That's correct.
2011 election?
2011.
Yes, sir.
Election.
I think that's not unreasonable. That's not an unreasonable perspective. It's very difficult to redistrict between when the census data is available, which is the middle of April, and a November election. In other words, to have all the public hearings that might be necessary, to draw proposed plans, to draft an ordinance, have the necessary readings, have it reviewed, send it to the Justice Department, have it pre-cleared, hopefully with no changes, and come back without changing the established election schedule.
Well, I would agree. Right. There are probably a few municipalities that might get it done, but
that's correct.
But certainly Aiken isn't one of them, given the change of our numbers.
Right.
And what I understood you further to say is that we will have an election in November based on the organization as it exists today.
Correct.
Okay. What time is the public hearing set for the June 2nd?
6 p.m.
Okay. Okay. I don't know whether that's a good time or not. But just a thought about whether a lot of folks are more comfortable with a 6 o'clock meeting or an earlier meeting. I think it's important before we have the public hearing that we produce as much information about this process as we can. In that vein, would it be possible for us to have a 6-1 proposal for the public to review? My concern, quite frankly, is that four of us live on the south side, kind of close to each other, and I don't know that you can come up with four districts and still, and I understand part of the process is to make minimum change and certainly to try not to legislate people out of a seat. And I know Mr. Bowers uses computers to do his work to a large degree. Is it possible to get a proposed 6-1 agreement that we can get out to the public so that when they come back to us on June 2nd, they at least will have seen what we're proposing to them for the election in November?
Certainly, if council wishes to have a proposal. That what a 6-1 plan might look like, then Mr. Bowers and staff could generate something. But of course, there are many ways to move lines and populations. But at least as a sample of what it may look like. Now, it's just to make sure I'm clear, the public hearing would discuss issues about whether to retain the 4-2-1, go to a 6-1. Some people may have comments on the election schedule and things of that nature. But if there is, as a result of that public hearing and its own deliberations, council chooses to go to something like a 6-1 plan, which is a change in the method of election under state law. Of course, there would be a referendum on that, as has been proposed in November at the general election. That actual plan would not be implemented until after that referendum, assuming it passes. And after the referendum passes, assuming it does, that's when work would begin on drawing an actual 6-1 plan that council might adopt by ordinance. So it's a two-step process.
So we're going to ask the folks to vote on something that they, I don't know, I thought the process was more defined, but we're going to ask, what you're saying is we're going to ask the people to vote on a 6-1, just the concept of a 6-1, not realizing the mechanics and the precise lines it would be drawn, just the concept of a 6-1.
That's correct, Councilman. That is how state law is set up and how it is usually done. But again, you know, if council as a body wishes to, at least for discussion purposes, see a concept.
Well, that'd be a waste of time. Quite frankly, I withdraw my comment. There's no point in asking for it if, based on what you're saying.
Yes, sir. It is a two-step process, the way state law is established.
So we're going to ask the people. Well, first of all, we have to clearly explain to the people that the 4-2-1 system as we currently have more than likely can't be accommodated based on the numbers in the 2010 census.
under the Voting Rights Act, it would be difficult to have Department of Justice pre-clear a revised 421 plan.
So given that, then our only choice is to come up with another scheme, and I don't use that word negatively, another system that the people have to vote on, whether it was a 511 or 6-1 or something along that line, that if the vote is approved, we would then, well, we have to even get Justice Department approval to have the election.
Correct.
That's right.
And then once the election is held, then we would go back and see what the results of the of that are. What happens if the people don't approve a 6-1?
Then one of your options would be to draw the best 421 plan you can under one person, one vote, and the Voting Rights Act, and submit it and see what happens.
And it would more than likely be rejected, I would expect.
Wouldn't we be doing that to start with?
No.
Having the best plan you could have. We already know some numbers that may not hold totally.
Right.
But we have a good feel for what the numbers are in the minority districts.
Yes.
And in my view, that won't pass.
Yes.
That's just my personal view. I think we all agree with that. So we know that much already. So do we really think that the Justice Department is going to approve that?
No.
Are we spinning our wheels? Are we wasting a little bit of time here? You know, with what I know we have to go through the process, but really.
Well, I think the question was.
Oh, I know that. We have to have public input.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we don't.
Yeah, but before any tentative decisions are made, public input, of course, is important.
Yeah.
But the question that I was responding to was if the people did not vote in favor of a 6-1 plan, assuming it was presented to them in a referendum, and it failed, so that option was off the table, then my response was, after that happens, if the referendum fails, then one of several options council may have is to draw the best 421 plan it can and submit it to Justice Department for review and see if it's pre-cleared. That's just an option if the referendum should fail.
And that's why I said, aren't we doing that to start with? Drawing the best 421 plan that there is.
As far as the first step is a public hearing, and then council will direct by introducing an ordinance for first reading whether to revise the 421 and submit it to the Justice Department or call for referendum on a 6-1 plan or some other plan. That's the initial decision.
I think
that's all right.
Huh?
That could be your discussion for June.
Yeah. It's just a little bit confusing. I think when we have a public hearing, we need to give as much detail as we can, concise, so people understand. And I hope that's what we'll have at the public hearing.
Yes, sir.
With Mr. Bowers, you and Mr. Bowers, Jim.
Right. Yes, sir.
He'll have pretty good numbers by that time.
Well, yes, sir. The numbers, the census numbers, of course, as applied to the existing four districts, are clear. The next step is based on that for council to decide whether to consider revising the 421 or consider changing the method of election and going to a 6-1 plan or something of that nature. And certainly we can provide I can provide legal advice, he can provide opinions, and he can provide demographic advice based on his experience as to what those options are and the possibilities of success.
He's got the statistical information.
Right, the statistical information. But Mr. Mayor and members of council, I hope you understand that in presenting information at this early stage, the purpose is to provide council information and the public information for you to decide and not try to insert any, at this early stage, any decision for you. In other words, to give you the information and let you, as the elected officials of the city, make those decisions. And if I'm being a little tentative in my comments, it's because I respect that authority on your part.
Mr. Mayor, I guess one of the things that I'm greatly interested in, and what, you know, we have to give 24-hour notice at a minimum in the newspaper. Well, what can Ms. Banton put in the paper for June the 2nd meeting? Can she put in the statistics that we have? You know, what can be in the newspaper, and how can we inform the public before they get here of what we've been talking about? And I think that part of it, you know, most of them are going to come in and all they're going to understand is what they vote today. They're not going to understand how it gets divided up or what numbers you're even using.
And to the extent that Mr. Holly can get that information to me, we'll make sure that it goes to all the media outlets that we provide information to, broadcast and print media.
But I would think
that information out.
Let me ask, I guess, both of you this. Are there any of the things that we've discussed here tonight can obviously will be in the minutes of tonight's meeting, but it won't be out yet? Is there something from tonight's minutes which are not approved, as we know, need to be put in the newspaper for June the 2nd or the package that we get out? You know, I'm looking how to get information out that we've discussed tonight, which is in a public forum, but yet these minutes won't be approved before June 2nd, obviously.
Well, what I would propose is that, you know, certainly Mr. Holly is in conversation with Mr. Bowers, and we know what information we have in hand. I would expect a packet of information this week, and we'll definitely push that out so that folks have that to look at, and then they can bring the questions or comments they have to that June 2nd meeting.
Can any of the discussions tonight be put in that, or would that be appropriate? You know, y'all can work out of the meeting and say, yeah, I said this, and that's okay to put in the...
I mean, I'd be happy to develop a memo.
I would like to do that if the rest of the council's pleasure. I don't want to do it just for me, but if I think information to the public is very important here.
Yeah. I think anything we say tonight is already public. We've got two cameras back there, and we've got lots of people here, and so I don't think that we are trying to keep anything from the public as to what we're saying tonight. I think that's public information already.
But the written word sometimes gets written different than what's in the minutes or what people understand from listening to the audio or the blip that's on TV for 10 seconds or the quarter page write-up in the Aiken Standard. And that's my concern, Beverly, that we see a package of this that the people can sit down and read. You know, maybe
I think the city manager has already said that as quickly as he could, he would get that packet and make it available for the public's.
Yeah, we could get that. I'd get it to all the media.
Yeah.
Very good.
Including members of the council. I guess the concern, it sounds kind of silly, but we're going to have a public hearing and people are going to come in and are going to, for the first time, it's my worry, for the first time, they're going to see what the issue is. Well, there's some homework that people can do beforehand if they have the right information. I mean, we have the numbers. We have the 2010 census results by district. I don't think that's been released to the public at all. I don't know if the press has seen it, but I certainly would hope that we would release it to the press. I mean, they're not classified, and I agree with Councilwoman Clyburn. There's nothing to be hidden in this process, and au contraire, we want to make as much of it as available to the public because we're going to ask for some significant changes in the way the city of Aiken is run, and I think the public needs to understand that very clearly, and that's all I'm looking for. We're saying essentially the 421 won't work, but we're not doing the 421 to show that it won't work, even though we know it's not going to work, and we're coming up with a 6-1, and we're going to say give this a shot, even though we're not going to be able to tell them that there might be one or two council members that are going to be districted out depending on how it happens. So I mean, if we don't do an excellent job of conveying this issue to the public, we're not going to have their support. And that's the last thing we want. This has got to be an open process, and everybody's got to understand what we're trying to do.
Well, and that really underscores the importance of tonight's discussion and the reason for having the resolution in your packet for adoption tonight. That gives us the path forward. Again, as Jim was just mentioning moments ago, we don't want to march in and say, here, council, here's what you need to do, just say yes. It's more of provide the information, provide the choices, have the public input, and then make a decision.
Well, if we can get some information out to the public by Wednesday or Thursday of this week, I'd be satisfied that at least people would have a week to think about it, and maybe if they've got questions, they can call their council person and ask the questions, even though we may or may not be able to answer any of them. But I'd like to have a prepared audience, quite frankly, on June 1st, so
Absolutely.
We can get some progress.
It'll be June
2nd. I'm sorry. June 2nd.
Let me see if I understand this correctly, Jim. This is as tight a schedule as we can get, is it not? I mean, there's no leeway in the schedule if we're going to meet all of the deadlines as set forth by the Justice Department. In the time it takes for us to get information to them and back from them, this is as tight as we could get it. As I look at the mathematics in this and the number of days you say it takes. So we can't, I don't know what we can change on the schedule. The only thing we can do is to do our best to get the information to the public in a timely fashion so that when we do have the meetings that they would be informed. It might be that they may not be any more informed than we might be at the same time. But I still think we need to go ahead and run the schedule at least up to September so that we can at least start the process. But if we put this off any longer, we know we are not going to be able to do it by November, so we need to go ahead and move forward with the schedule as it is right now and change the schedule as information comes in, okay. Is what I see.
Do we need a motion, or has the motion been made?
I have a question, Jim. There is only one public hearing that you know of.
Yes, ma'am.
And where is this public hearing?
Where will it be located?
Yes. It was going to be here on June 2nd.
Here in this?
All right. Now, depending on how that public meeting goes and any ordinance that would be drafted, and understand that Jim has mentioned we would have to do an ordinance, that's two additional public meetings. So it's actually three. It's not just one.
And then every council meeting is a public meeting, so you've got all of those built in.
That's right.
One on the 13th, one on the 27th.
And the ordinance would just be if council felt it was necessary to actually hold the referendum. There would be additional public meetings if the referendum was approved or not approved.
And at the June 2nd meeting, if there was an overflow in this room, how do we get, we tell folks that they can't attend, how do we handle the overflow in the?
Well, I mean, we've got space downstairs, okay, that will hold more folks. If, okay, we think we're going to have a capacity crowd, we could certainly have it downstairs. Okay. I mean, we've got space available.
Okay.
We certainly want everyone to participate. No one should feel that they're not included, because we want everyone to participate.
Well, procedure-wise, assuming everything goes as designed, we get our public hearing, we get the two meetings. We submit it to DOJ. What if DOJ doesn't come back with an approval prior to the November 8th referendum?
Assuming council passes an ordinance changing, calling for a referendum, with the subject being a change from the 421 plan to a 6-1 plan, and we submit that to the Justice Department in early July, they have 60 days to respond. I've been pretty successful, I think, in never having them request additional information. So we generally get a response within 50 to 60 days. We will ask for expedited consideration, which may mean they may take a little bit less time. If council submits a 6-1 plan, I would be very surprised, a referendum on a 6-1 plan, I would be very surprised if the Justice Department does not, and the term is pretty clear that, and so that it would be on the ballot in time for the November 8th election. I hope that answers your question. I mean, if that's the issue that's submitted of the referendum, they generally do allow referenda to occur, so I think they would allow that to proceed. Now, the one thing I just want to, if I may, you know, as we go forward on this, there can be changes and surprises during the process, and at some point, council may or may not have to consider a change in the election schedule or the timing of implementation of any new plan you do develop. So just keep that in mind as we go forward, that there's a part of this that is somewhat fluid, and you deal with it as you go along. But this is the objective that we understand council wishes to proceed to achieve at this time, is to make a concerted effort to keep the election schedule in place and to implement during future general elections that will be already on the schedule every 2 years. That's the objective that we understand that you want to achieve.
And Jim, I mean, it's a fair characterization. You're using the information you have to now enter into the due diligence that you've practiced in the past.
Correct.
Are we ready for a motion?
Yes, we are.
So moved.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Are we going to release the numbers we have to the press?
As soon as I get the packet of information, we'll push it out. Yes.
Well, we have. We've already been given it, haven't we?
We can post that. That's no problem at all.
Okay.
Mr. Dwara.
Thank you.
Not a problem.
And it's the information is also, I think, available on census websites mm-hmm. and the Office of Research and Statistics of the State Budget Control.
Yeah. Okay. Here again, I'd rather that information come from our group. So if right. Mr. Holly needs to put that out, if we let the citizens start searching everything, we'll all be in the wrong county.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Edgar. I mean, from your city manager's office, we'd like to have a packet of information and put it out.
That's I agree.
Not a problem.
I agree.
Do it as quickly as we can. I can't commit to a time right here tonight until I actually have everything. But we will expedite it and make sure it gets out.
Okay. I'll call for the question.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor,
can I ask a question, please? Yeah. Bill, come up to the mic if you would, Bill.
That's a good one for a 70-year-old.
Oh, my God. You done told me he's not going to run that. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. There's a couple of things that I would like to be clear on, and I'm a friend of the council, so I just want to know. Am I understanding this correctly, that in spite of the numbers that the districts have right now, and remembering that there were some additions to the city which increased the population, which was self-inflicted, that we did, and of course we were in the call with that, and as a result of that, the districts are now out of proportion with numbers as it relates to the 1965 Civil Rights Act. Having said that, are we sure now, and maybe counsel can get me straight on this, are we sure now that the Justice Department will accept a continuation of what we've had with the districts being as they are right now? I'm a little bit afraid of that. One example is, you know, when I ran for the House several years ago, I ran three times in 2 years because the Justice Department said, in essence, is that you should have had these numbers right, and we don't like it, so we're going to make you run again. And that would be really terrible for a candidate, regardless of who the candidate is. And I wish I was a little more clear on whether we should continue to have an election the way it's set up right now, or really should we shoot for having a possibly 6-1 district for the upcoming election? I think we need to kind of give that some thought, because if we miss it, we're going to have a lot of confusion for the next couple of years.
Well, you're making a very important point, Congressman. We're essentially going to have the next election without regard to the 2010 numbers, and it's going to be kind of a distortion, and I don't know whether that puts us at risk or not, but your point's well taken. We need to be very careful with what we do. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're right. I mean, if we have this election, I assume it's possible a Justice Department could void the election if they don't think it was fair in compliance with the law.
The only way that I thought it would work is if we would have a referendum first for 6-1. That would mean that we probably have to move the election date if we did that. But at least you'd know what you have in terms of having the voters to decide on whether they want to remain as is with the 4-2-1 or a 6-1 election. You'd have that voting up front.
I'm sure.
I think we need Mr. Holly to mention on that. He is our resident expert here. be sure we get his opinion on this. I don't disagree with you, Congressman, but I think Mr. Holly is our representative right now that's in the know, so, or as know as he can be.
Now, you may be making a federal case out of Mr. Cliver, because yeah. He comes in our state house of representatives. Very ably. Very ably.
Thank you, Bill.
But House representative. These kind of issues potentially would be coming out of the public meeting that you're going to have next Thursday, just a week and a half from now.
And I agree with your comment. One of the reasons for the public hearing is to get input like that. And as I said, there are parts of this that are fluid. I believe what Representative Clyburn was talking about was the option of holding off the next election cycle, assuming there is a new plan, and having the election under the new plan 6 months after November or 9 months after November. And certainly that is an option to do. In the past, the city was successful in making changes while keeping the established election schedule. You know, the numbers that we're dealing with is not as favorable to the city as they were then. And there have been drops in the minority population in districts 1 and 2, and that's something that we can talk about and get input from at the public hearing. And that's, again, one of the decisions council will have to make. Regardless of which plan it opts for, the next question is whether to stay on the current schedule or to delay the elections, which also would have to be pre-cleared by the Justice Department. So those are things we can talk about when if council stayed on the current schedule, and assuming it opted for a 6-1 plan, we sent the referendum up there in July. We would include in that indication to the Justice Department that the current election schedule would be maintained if that's what council decides. Mm-hmm. And then Justice would have a chance to comment on that within that 60-day period. Then council could stay on course or change its plan. Or the other option is council make that call on the election schedule before we submit it to the mm-hmm. Justice Department, adopt an ordinance, and we, the problem with that is, let me catch up myself, you've got to have the results of the referendum to know what the plan's going to be. If Justice Department pre-clears, say, a 6-1 referendum, you have to have the referendum to know whether or not to redistrict to 6-1 or change to something else.
And again, this is not something that council is going to settle tonight.
Right.
The only thing you're trying to do tonight is to start the process.
Right.
And I think it's going to be helpful to have Mr. Bowers here with statistical right. information next Thursday so that the continued discussion and some of these issues that are coming up tonight are certainly very appropriate for the public meeting that you're going to have next Thursday.
But again, the two things we have to get done first are the public hearing, the ordinance. Then if there's a referendum, the results of that referendum, to know what the future is, and then council to draw whatever plans are necessary after a referendum, if there is one.
Just for my edification, what if the public hearing, after the public hearing, the public sentiment is to stay with a 4-2-1? What do we do? I mean, you're saying we have to come up with a 6-1 plan.
No,
say something else. What is the something else?
Now, I think my comment was that if, based on the census data, if council simply redistricts the existing four districts, it would be difficult to get preclearance of that from the Justice Department under the Voting Rights Act. Okay. If the public hearing, the sentiment is one way or the other, council has to decide whether or not what its decision is going to be, taking into account that public sentiment is expressed at a public hearing, just like it would any other public hearing. Sometimes you implement the sentiment, sometimes you have to make a different decision.
But the problem that we're running into, if I'm understanding correctly, is not with the Civil Rights Act of 1965 as we currently stand in the 4-2-1 system, but the problem we're encountering is the one person, one vote currently.
The most challenging problem right now for the city is the existing demographics of the four district based on one person, one vote. But at the same time, the existing numbers of the two minority districts have decreased, and so they're not as strong minority-wise as they were 10 years ago. And so that presents an issue that has to be analyzed, too, and might in and of itself at some point in the future require redistricting just under the Voting Rights Act.
To add to that, based on the growth, we have approved growth to take place in one specific area of our community. And in approving that, this has gone to the Justice Department for review, and we've said that it does not adversely impact the voting strength of this community. So all that has to be considered as we look at what we said to the Justice Department versus where we're going.
Yeah, but, and that is contained in the resolution you have before you today.
Call for the question.
You got a motion in a second.
What?
Yeah, I know. I know.
We have a motion in second. Show of hands, please. All in favor.
Okay.
Passage. Okay. Passes unanimously. Item 7, resolution to approve senior commission bylaws. Mr. Pierce, please.
Council approved the establishment of a senior commission by prior ordinance as part of their mandate from City Council. Mayor, they have developed bylaws, and that is the resolution that is before you tonight, if I may. Yeah, it's just a resolution to approve the senior commission bylaws, and that's for approval.
Okay, do we have a motion and second?
I move we approve the senior commission bylaws, Mr. Mayor.
I'll second that, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, any discussion?
Just one comment. I assume the senior commission will have be greatly involved in the Eustis Park Area Center. I assume that's an assumption, or do we need...
Absolutely. I think as we develop a site plan and a design and just have a discussion about what amenities or features should be at the proposed senior youth center, there are several interested stakeholders in that. The folks, certainly the folks who live in the neighborhood, the senior commission, there may be other boards and commissions or committees that also have an interest in it. This is something that eventually has to go through a process, so certainly that would be a valuable group.
Okay, we've got a motion and second. Show of hands, please. All in favor. Passes unanimously.
And I think Mr. Wells was out of the room.
Yeah. Okay, under petitions and requests, we have two, but first, Mr. Jim Batten wants to discuss public safety arrest procedures.
For having me here. I want to discuss what to me seems to be a situation where the City of Aiken police are not enforcing the laws the same for every person here in Aiken. I believe the people that should be arrested are being released, and there's a good chance they're coming back to kill people later on in other accidents.
Okay.
I've got a letter that I wrote concerning a wreck that happened on December 25th, Christmas evening. And I'll just read it. It addresses what happens. I've got a follow-up letter that summarizes my concerns, and it's based on discussions I've had with various people. On December 25th, 2010, around 6 p.m.
Jim, excuse me.
Yes.
Talk into the mic.
Okay.
Please.
On December 25th, 2010, around 6 p.m., a wreck occurred on Highway 118, the Aiken Bypass, that almost killed two people. My son's girlfriend was driving a 2004 Infiniti, and the pastor was my sister-in-law. They were traveling north up the hill in front of New Covenant Presbyterian Church. A 1999 Ford Expedition heading south crossed the turn lane and struck the Infiniti head-on. It was dark. The Expedition had the headlights turned off. Take into account, just keep in mind, this was Christmas night. The Expedition had the headlights turned off. There were three Hispanics in the Expedition. According to the witness in the car behind the Infiniti, once the Expedition stopped, the occupant in the backseat of the Expedition fled on foot. I'd also like to point out that I was at the accident scene probably 10 minutes after it happened. I was at the accident scene probably within 10 minutes of it occurring. So what I'm talking about here is what I heard on the scene. I talked to these people. It's not hearsay. When police arrived, the driver of the Expedition told the police through an interpreter that he was not the driver and that the driver fled on foot. The witness identified the driver of the vehicle to the policeman at the scene and informed the policeman that the Expedition headlights were turned off. At that point, the police knew the driver was lying to him. The driver of the Expedition had no identification, no insurance, no driver's license. The man, the City of Aiken police, charged the driver with reckless driving and no driver's license. He was not tested for alcohol or drugs. While talking to the police, he started complaining of not feeling good, and the police immediately sent him and his remaining passenger to the MCG hospital to be checked out. My son knows many EMT people, paramedics, and he got some information from one of the paramedics. I don't even know the person's name, but according to the source, the driver was intoxicated when he arrived at the hospital. He also had drugs in his possession. I know that night at MCG, security was trying to figure out what to do with the drugs that this person had, because we're sitting there listening to him while we're in the ICU waiting room. The hospital released both men. Amanda, that was the girl that was hurt. Her brother contacted the people who do the alcohol and drug testing training for the City of Aiken. And he asked the guy, if somebody's driving at nighttime on a holiday, driving with no headlights, dark road, goes across the median and hits somebody head on, would that normally, require that person to be tested for alcohol? He said, of course it would. Definitely it would. Okay, the guy was not tested for alcohol. Okay. My son's girlfriend experienced a broken jaw, a broken femur bone or left leg, broken wrist, lacerated wrist, broken kneecap, lacerated liver, lacerated spleen. Anyway, a few nights after the wreck, I contacted my neighbor, Captain Wendell Hall, who's the City of Aiken Police Department. He's the captain. I asked him why the driver was not arrested. He informed me that the Hispanic, who I was assumed at the time this letter was written, was an illegal alien, and he is. It was confirmed. Anyway, he told me that this guy could not be treated any different from me. And I informed the captain that I would have been arrested for no insurance, no license, no headlights, being intoxicated, lying to the police, and causing the wreck. I asked him, what does it take to arrest an illegal alien? His answer was, I quote, we do not arrest illegal aliens unless they are in possession of a gun. After I discussed this with Fred Kavanaugh, our mayor, investigators followed up on this Hispanic driver. This is the information that was given to me by Mr. Kavanaugh and also Pete Frommer. The Hispanic driver gave a false name at the scene of the wreck. Once his real name, and I'm not sure if anybody knows his real name, was determined, the police discovered that he is currently wanted on several other felony warrants. And again, this is what I was told at the time. The only problem is the driver cannot be found since he was not arrested when the accident occurred. The same time period, the wreck on 302 occurred. That driver was arrested. In this case, the driver that knew, in this accident that I'm discussing, he was turned loose. Anyway, it got me thinking, you know, what's going on here? Why was this guy not checked for alcohol? Why was he only charged with no driver's license and reckless driving? Also, too, I know that Christmas evening, if I see somebody driving out almost in the country with no headlights, nighttime, the first thing I think is they're drunk. And again, you know, our contacts confirmed he was drunk. You can pass this. These are some pictures of the Infiniti and also Amanda. So I written a letter. This was sent, I believe. I've sent a lot of letters out, but this pretty much summarizes the reason why I am upset and concerned and why I want to discuss this tonight. So far, nobody will discuss Pete Frommer's and apparently the city police's policy not to arrest illegal aliens when they break the law. Now, I've had several discussions with different people, including Mr. Frommer, I believe twice. As stated earlier, Mr. Frommer told me they do not arrest illegals involved in wrecks because the city of Aiken will get upset if they have to assume the medical expenses for the illegal. I go on to say Captain Hall confirmed this policy when he told me that unless the illegal has a gun, they are not arrested. Now, I am not here pushing to arrest illegal aliens. I am pushing to get the city of Aiken to enforce existing laws without taking into account profiling of the individuals breaking the laws. That pretty much summarizes why I'm here. I've left out some of the details concerning some of the people I've talked to because, you know, it's like my word against theirs. But what I'm telling you is the truth. And, you know, I'm upset that these people, they're killing people, or almost killing people, are getting turned loose so that they can do it again. I was also told that this guy has now, he was being tracked down by the FBI, and that he was in Atlanta. I've also been told the only thing that he's got against him is a few traffic tickets. That does not make sense. I know I've gotten from the city of Aiken a little bit of information on his background. There are 4 mug shots, and he's got 3 aliases. I don't know what else he's been charged with. Initially, I was told that he was wanted for murder in Mexico, and that I should feel comforted that knowing that he would not go back to Mexico, he would stay in the United States. I got a problem with that. Later on, I was told by Pete Frommer that his girlfriend was lying. It's not true. However, I don't know what he's wanted for in Mexico. I don't know what he's wanted for here. But I know in a normal situation, a normal citizen, legal citizen of Aiken, that person would have been arrested on the spot. If you look in the blotter in the Aiken Standard, you will see where people are always getting arrested for lying to the police. I've always been told, I have been told that you would not have been arrested. I would not have been arrested for no driver's license and reckless driving. But I would have been charged and I would have been arrested for all the other offenses, including, I'm sure the Aiken police would have followed up enough to give me a breathalyzer to find out I was drunk. That definitely is an arresting, you know, offense. So, what I want to hear is what is the city of Aiken going to do about it? You know, are they going to ignore the problem? Are they going to say that I'm lying? I don't know. But I do not like what I saw. Because this guy is still out there somewhere, and he's going to meet somebody else in the same situation. He's probably going to kill him.
Jim, there's no doubt this is an extremely tragic situation, and I'm sorry you and your family and the young lady had to go through this. I would like to call on Pete if he would respond to what you've said, and I just think we need to get both sides of the issue out on the table. We've had several conversations, Jim, you and I, at church and different places, and I know you set up a meeting. We set up a meeting for you to talk with Richard and Pete, I think, at one point in time.
We did.
So we've certainly tried to talk this thing through. And yes, Steve, what?
Have you had access to the police report on the incident?
Yes. I've got it with me. And in the police report, nothing was mentioned about the guy lying. Nothing was mentioned about the fact that the passenger ran, which is another red flag. So here is the accident report.
Jim, just curious, what is Amanda's condition now?
She's just started working full time.
Good for her. Good.
Pete, would you like to respond at this point?
Of course, after this accident occurred and Mr. Banton got in touch with me, of course, I've checked my procedures to make sure we followed all of our procedures. We did. We got with my city attorney, got with the solicitor. We've completely reviewed the case, and everything we've done in the case, the way we handled it, the way we investigated it, the information we have done things properly. Of course, we're bound by law, things we can do, things we can't do. For instance, in a lot of the earlier conversations with Mr. Banton, he was, he was upset because this person was here illegally in the country. We don't have any laws that allows me to arrest somebody just because they're here illegally. We treat everybody, if they're a U.S. citizen or if they're here illegally, we treat them the same. We investigate whatever the charges are. And we make those charges based on the facts of the case.
When you have a traffic wreck, Pete, what typically would result in an arrest from a traffic wreck?
The only time would be for driving under the influence. Of course, we probably have close to 100 wrecks a month in the city. We don't arrest people for wrecks. They get charged for reckless driving and careless driving and speeding and failure to yield, but we don't arrest people for having wrecks and receiving traffic tickets. For the most part, we arrest people for felony type cases. Thefts, shoplifting, robbery, burglaries, that sort of case. And we have serious wrecks. I mean, we, probably a couple or two, three wrecks a month happen in this town where people are injured, cars are turned over, demolished, and everything. But we don't arrest people just because they had a traffic accident. What we do is following the wreck. Of course, a bad wreck, usually people will be taken to the hospital, and then we will go to the hospital. And of course, a lot of cases not then because they're injured. They don't know. They can't understand what you're saying. They're incoherent. So, but we'll come back days later and we issue a traffic citation and summons them to appear in court.
Okay, that was going to be my question. I saw on the incident report there where the responding officer said that due to the injuries that he was unable to issue a citation, and I'm sure that happens when both parties are injured and need medical attention, that they are taken then to the hospitals. And then is there some monitoring system on that? Or let's say these were taken to Medical College of Georgia, which I don't know that we would have any jurisdiction there.
We don't have any jurisdiction.
So until they were released and possibly came back to Aiken,
correct.
That wouldn't have been possible. Anything.
Or as in this case, you know, we found out the ID of this person, what we assume was ID. We found he had a job in Aiken. He had a family in Aiken. He has a girlfriend. So, you know, by the next day, we knew a history of this person, where we were pretty confident who he was, where his job was, where his family lived, where his girlfriend. So, you know, confident that we know who he is and where we could find him. Of course, in this case, he, you know, knew from us going around checking on his job, his family, he knew we were looking for him, and then he fled. Of course, at that point, we had information. Originally, his girlfriend was the one that told us that she thought he might have had some murder warrants out of Mexico. So that was our involvement with FBI. We immediately got with them, started checking out that story, along with ICE, and they came back within a day or so and said, "Nope, he has no record."
The collision report does show that he was issued the two summonses of Mr. Bat.
We issued warrants on him, and of course those warrants are still active. We still to this day, you know, almost 6 months later, we still go by and check the family's house. We check the girlfriend. You know, by all means, the case is not going cold. We have our officials with ICE Immigration helping us try to locate them. So until we can locate them, there are outstanding warrants. And of course, we arrest people on warrants. If we can find him, he will be arrested on those warrants, book him in the jail, and of course we'll go before the judge and try and get a bond denial that he is a flight risk.
I got three quick questions. Did this individual have any outstanding warrants on him? I'm talking about the driver of the Explorer.
No.
No outstanding warrants. Is that a normal procedure now that we've given you the computers where you can actually check on that individual?
That.
Okay.
Yeah.
Second question I have is, if you're at night and you wind up in an accident, and it's an accident that is kind of like derelict, where you cross over or you drive off in the ditch, do you not automatically test that individual for intoxication of some sort?
Only way you do that is if you have a probable cause. So if you get there, the person is still there, you talk to him, you smell alcohol, you see him walking and stumbling, you get testimony from other people about his behavior, what they saw, what they heard. But of course, in this case, pretty well he was injured, the ambulance came, they packaged him up, and they were away.
Jim?
I had something. As I mentioned, I got to the accident scene just a few minutes. And throughout the duration, I'm standing but this is for me and the driver. Well, it's about for me to you, Don. And he's talking the whole time, but he's talking to the interpreter. He did not appear to be injured. He wasn't injured. He got released when he got to the hospital. He was drunk. But the whole time, he's got his head stuck in the car facing his interpreter. He wouldn't even look at the officer. And it was not one of these things where the guy's laying on the ground dying. He was not hurt. And again, you know, what bothers me the most is I was told by Mr. Frommer, and I do not lie. I always suspect somebody when they say I don't lie. It should be a given that you don't lie. But he told me that in general, if an illegal alien is involved in a car wreck, they don't arrest him because he knows the people in the city of Aiken will get upset if they have to pay all these doctor bills. We discussed the fact that he probably doesn't have insurance, he probably doesn't work, and he probably don't pay taxes. So, again, and also, like I said, Captain Wendell Hall told me, point blank, unless they have a gun, we don't arrest them. That's not treating everybody the same. That's not enforcing the laws the same. I call it reverse profiling, and I've got a problem with it.
Chief, I got one more question. Jim interrupted.
Respond to that. Well, it's still fresh. Of course, as far as medical needs, you know, we're public safety. We're not medical type people. When we have a wreck, the folks at EMS, they will look at people, talk to them. They'll make their decision whether they need to go to the hospital. And we stay clear. That's their decision. We have no input. We have no input what hospital, where they go to Aiken or the trauma center. Because, of course, with us, you know, we can't try and talk them into keeping somebody from going to the hospital just so we can arrest them. You know, if somebody says they need medical help, and we then allow them to get it, and then they die later on, guess who's will be liable. So as far as all the medical decisions of going to the hospital or not going to the hospital, where they go, we stay clear of that. That's up to the trained medical professionals.
My experience is most medical emergency rooms have a public safety officer assigned. Is there a procedure where if you have a person that has an accident in Aiken County and that individual is potentially, you know, at fault, is there any way you give a heads up to the individual that's sitting alert, if you will, at the MCG emergency room or one of the other hospital emergency rooms? Is there any coordination between the person, the public safety officer at the emergency room and the people on scene, or just, I mean, you totally lose control of the individual?
Not for traffic charge type offenses. If it was a felony, somebody that killed somebody, robbed a bank, a felony type thing, we had the communication set up with the security where we would tell them to keep an eye on them. And of course, we would have to get the proper warrants and of course the papers to allow us to go to Georgia, which takes time. And then we would just tell them, you know, try and watch them, let us know if they try.
Who do you tell?
Security. They have security at MCG and University.
The second question fourth question I have is just looking at that picture of that infinity. I mean, it's very likely that individual, the woman, had suffered maybe much more serious injuries than she apparently had. I mean, they were serious enough, but I mean, with that, the looks like the whole side of the car was crushed. I mean, that individual could have been, you know, fatally injured eventually or whatever.
Well, we went to our solicitor, showed him the pictures, gave him the reports, explained what happened. And if she had died, well, then they could upgrade the charges. But based on the victim still being alive, still being treated, based on the information we had at that time, the solicitor told us we had the appropriate charges.
I hear
charges.
What you're saying, but yeah. Basically, you're going to upgrade the charges to whatever, manslaughter, but you lost control of the individual. The individual was gone.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious, is there a procedure?
We're guided by law what we can do.
And you did.
Probably our solicitor can answer that better. But
Pete, before you leave the microphone, you did issue a summons to city court, and he did not appear. So
correct.
Did I hear you correctly to say that there is an arrest warrant out for him now for not appearing in court
correct.
On those charges?
Correct.
Okay, because he's been convicted of the charges.
Correct.
Just one thing on a regular driving under influence case, the officer would have to read the individual implied consent warning before obtaining the sample. So you can't call ahead and by proxy have a MCG public safety officer make the seizure of the person's blood when they have not been informed of their implied consent rights. And your implied consent rights are basically what you hear about with the breathalyzer that applies to blood too. That the person has a right to refuse the test. And there's a specific warning under state law that we have to give them in writing, explain it to them, et cetera. So that's why you can't just call ahead and say, hey, pull a blood sample for me in advance and have that MCG officer do that because we'd be violating the implied consent statute.
I appreciate what you're saying, but I'm not concerned about whether he blows a balloon or gives blood or whatever.
Well,
I'm talking about physically losing control of the individual if he's potentially. I mean, it could have been a lot more serious incident, and basically we farm these people out to MCG, and all of a sudden nobody knows where they are. I mean, do we know where he is today? We don't.
Right.
Implied consent. I understand that.
Well,
but I'm saying
to make the charge. We got to have the probable cause, and if it doesn't exist, you can't make the charge to, put that hold on the person before you have the evidence in place. And that's really the problem. These are difficult situations for the officers because it's happening so fast, and they're getting taken across state lines.
But if you're legalizing me on this. If you cross the center line going at 50 miles an hour, that's not reckless driving, that's dangerous driving. Isn't there a higher grade of violation?
No, sir.
Reckless
is the high.
Yeah, that's it. That's the highest. If reckless driving and they kill someone, there's reckless homicide statute. But short of a fatality, reckless driving in itself is only reckless driving. That's the highest charge it currently is. So that's really all the officer had evidence of at that point.
Pete.
Ben, just a quick one. From a legal viewpoint, do we lose anything by transporting these people out of state?
It makes it more difficult. And as Pete got into, what we're faced with is you got two issues, the potential criminal case and then the medical treatment. And we don't want to be in a situation where we say, hey, he's got to go to Aiken Regional and force the medics, I don't know how we do that, but have the authority to do it, but force them to take him to Aiken Regional when that person needs to go to the trauma center at MCG, and then that person passes because the trauma center would have been the better place for them. I mean, priority number one is treat the person.
Sure.
And so, but once they cross the state lines, obviously it would be a lot better for us if they were still within our jurisdiction to deal with.
But Aiken Regional does not have a trauma center. Is that what you're saying?
They do not.
That's what I'm saying. You actually have a number of choices, like university over there and so forth. Yeah. But anyway, the medics say this is where this guy needs to go. And, unfortunately,
Ben,
with being on the state line, really. But
let me ask you one question, and that is, whose decision was it to transport him in the first place if he was able to flee once he got there? I mean, was that EMS, or who made the decision that he was sick enough, that he was hurt enough to go there?
We always leave that to EMS. From my understanding of the facts we heard, I think a passenger was the one who fled.
The gentleman that you're looking for now.
Yes, sir.
How long did he stay in the hospital when he got there?
I do not know.
He was released
Right after he got there. So a call was made that he needed to go all the way to Georgia, where he was immediately released. Is that right?
I don't know when he was released, but they made that decision. I don't know why they made it. Could be that the young lady needed to go there too, and I can only speculate why the EMTs made that decision. But like Pete said, we do leave it to the medical professionals to say where the person needs to go.
Who was the interpreter?
I have no idea. I was thinking it was somebody who was actually with him in the car, but I don't know.
Let's let Pete come in the microphone.
I don't know.
Okay. But Pete, as the case sits today, you've got arrest warrants pending for this individual.
Correct.
You're continuing to work with FBI and ICE.
Correct.
As well. And if the public has any information, that would be helpful to the efforts. So we're going to continue to pursue the case?
Most definitely.
Okay. Yeah.
From what I'm hearing, there are two people at large the one that was alleged, the one that was said to have allegedly left the scene, that fled quickly. Is that right? Okay.
But that's not against the law. You can
right, but I'm saying that's an allegation. You don't know don't know the bit to it all. But that this is what someone told you. And the second one is the one that when he went to MCG.
The driver.
The driver.
Those are, that's who we have the charges on.
Okay.
The driver.
But we don't know anything about the other individual. That could be something that this individual just said to us.
Correct.
Okay.
One thing that concerns me, sticks with me, is that difference that you and Jim have in what was said. You said Wendell Hall, Jim told you that definitely would be that he would be arrested if I remember what you said.
Captain Hall told me they do not arrest. He does not arrest illegal aliens unless they're carrying a gun. Otherwise, okay. They're not arrested. They turn loose. Apparently, they're too big of a headache.
Okay, well, in this case, you wouldn't arrest anyone anyway. You charged them.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But there was no arrest. It wouldn't have been an arrest anyway then. I misunderstood what I thought Captain Hall told you.
Fred came when I presented a hypothesis that I was driving instead of the illegal. Mm-hmm. And the hypothesis said, I'm driving at nighttime with no headlights. I've got no insurance, no license, and I lied to the policeman saying the man that ran was the driver. My question was, would I have been arrested? And the answer was, yes.
But that's assuming you were not hurt, right?
That's assuming I am in the illegal alien's shoes, and it had been me driving the exact same scenario.
Even if the EMS worker had said you needed to go to the hospital, you think they would have arrested you?
I think so. I was told I would be, so yes, I did.
And Pete, you say that's not...
I talked to Wendell. Mr. Batten just took some conversations out of context.
And again, I had a witness with me when we had the conversation, but forget that. My concern is... And you can deny this if you want. You told me y'all will not arrest illegal aliens in car accidents because the city of Bacon people do not want to pay the medical bills. That is what you told me.
Not in that context.
Probably not with that excitement I have right now, but again, and that, regardless of the wreck, I don't care if you never find this guy, but I know that the way City of Aiken are treating illegal aliens, turn them loose, I call it catch and release. There's going to be people getting hurt. It might be me, it might be you, it might be your family, but I've got a problem with that. Knowing that unless they're carrying a gun, they're going to be released, period. I got a problem with that.
Mayor, if it would be helpful to council, based on the information that's presented tonight, I can follow up with Pete and his command staff, and we will do a policy review as to the exact policy and provide that information to council.
Please.
In the meantime, there are arrest warrants for this particular individual from that particular incident, and as I understand what Pete is saying is that his staff will continue to diligently try to find this person and make sure that they do come to justice.
Chief, have we arrested illegal aliens in the past?
On felony charges.
We have.
Yeah, we don't arrest people for traffic accidents.
But you have for DUIs and that kind of thing.
DUIs fit for, if it's reckless driving, careless speeding, whether you're illegal or a U.S. citizen, we don't arrest people for
traffic
accidents.
I think it's very important to review the policy just to make sure again and also with the officers, make sure everybody understands exactly. I'm not saying they don't, but this is a good time to review and make sure that we're doing everything right, and everybody knows what's right.
Seems like, Mr. Mayor, I read an article just recently, I forget exactly where it applied, but the municipality or the entity decided if they could not provide insurance, you know, assuming they're stopped for whatever reason, accident or speeding or some kind of traffic violation, if they cannot provide proof of insurance, the vehicle is impounded. It might be something the council might want to think about. I mean, to be honest with you, I read the paper and I see all these traffic stops and no license, no license, no license. I mean, it's getting a little bit old.
And we didn't do the same now. If you don't have insurance on your car, we tow it.
You do tow it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's a good step. What about if the person doesn't have a valid insurance, a valid driver's license?
We charge them for driving without a license.
And what do you do with the vehicle? He drives off?
We give them a chance. If they have a family member that can get there pretty quickly, they can drive it. If not, we tow it.
Oh, okay.
Did you tow the vehicle in this case?
Do you know? They were wrecked.
Huh?
They did. Correct. They were not drivable. They had been in a traffic accident, and they were not drivable.
And who was the vehicle registered to?
To his girlfriend. You know, he was driving somebody else's car. And she had insurance on the car. We knew who owned the car, and we knew they had insurance on it. Yeah.
Okay. Any more comments on council?
Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm Debbie Nix, 808 Woodward Street. I'm a victim of a drunk driver. In 1982, my husband and I were on a date night in Augusta, Georgia. We were in a turn lane, and we were hit full speed by a car behind us. It broke the seat, our front seat in half, and totaled our car and left me with a lifetime neck injury. The man was charged with drunk driving right there on the spot because, to me, could they not smell the alcohol? There has to be, if he's upright, there's a missing gap here. My concern is for the victim. The victim will probably have lifelong problems from this, and the guy that perpetrated it is getting off scot-free. For what reason? We actually were the first televised hearing and the first case of this televised hearing in Augusta, Georgia, and he was charged, and he had no license either, and no insurance. The same thing. And as a result, I was very involved with Mothers Against Drunk Drivers because I had a baby at home when that occurred, and it changes your life. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Now, there's a question that there's a difference here of opinion about whether or not they were drinking or had drugs or alcohol, for that matter. Tim, you said they did, and I guess the officer said they didn't. Is that? Maybe I didn't say it right, but I think the point is there's a difference of opinion here.
Yeah, I think it all goes back to probable cause and the laws and what the laws say we must have and must see.
We'll do that as part of our review and give a report to council.
Okay. But I mean, was it clear from your officers at the time that there was no smell of alcohol?
I can't answer that.
We'll follow up on that, Mayor. Okay. Get that background information. There's some details.
Well, yeah.
The whole time that he was talking, again, I'm standing 5 feet from the officer and the driver. He kept his face in the interpreter's car. It was a car that somebody could speak Spanish in English. He kept his face towards his interpreter. He would not look at his.
Okay. So you couldn't be sure either, but
he got to the hospital. The contact person that told my son about the guy said he was some oxygen drunk.
We'll follow up with the hospital and check into that, Mayor. We just got some information we need to verify.
Mr. Mayor, I think she had her hand.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Kathy Pate, 207 East Middlebury Lane, and I have a really big question about the drunk driving issue as well, and what causes that. I remember hearing a story or reading a story. It was, I don't know if it was 4 or 5, maybe 6 months ago, about an incident where there was a wreck. I believe it was in the morning, right out in front of the, I think it's called the break room on Whiskey Road. Mm-hmm. And a girl was on top of the car, and the mom drove out into the road and slung the girl off the car. I mean, it was the craziest story mm-hmm. you ever heard. But the woman, the driver, was transported to MCG, but she was also charged and was in jail that day after they released her. She was charged with drunk driving. And so I'm not sure what the differences are. I mean, they were able to get her at the hospital or whatever at MCG, and then she was taken to jail. So I don't know how the situation is different, because to me they're both car accidents. You know, there was somebody that was driving drunk, and how can you have people say that this person was drunk at the hospital, but the officer not? I'm curious about what are the procedures.
Our city solicitor is very anxious to address your concern.
I'm curious about the procedures for how they determine that.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy.
Well, number one, we can't comment on the case that she mentioned because it's a pending case. Ethically, the prosecutor or anybody from the city can't comment on that particular case while it's pending. As far as procedures, it's not impossible to get blood sample from somebody when they go to MCG, but you would have to get somebody over there to read the implied consent. You'd have to have the adequate probable cause to do that, and there's more hurdles for us to obtain a blood sample, or in some cases people refuse it, but it can be done. I can talk more specifically with her about it, but my response earlier wasn't that it's impossible, but you can't just call ahead and have someone, hey, it's not as simple as calling MCG, hey, pull a vial of blood, we got a DUI situation. There's other things we got to do, and we'd have to get an officer there physically present to do the implied consent advisement and so forth.
Didn't we just celebrate a couple of our peace officers just recently about how well they've done on DUI checks and so forth?
Yes, we did.
What's the difference between that and a case where it's one thing to get stopped at a roadblock where all the cars are checked and so forth, as opposed to somebody driving across a median, racking into another vehicle, and then not even giving a breathalyzer or even offering a breathalyzer?
Well, that's going to go to the officers at the scene. Yeah. I mean, I've prosecuted these cases for 10 years, and in the 10 years of prosecuting the DUI cases in city court, rarely was it a case of a roadside stop or license check. It was typically by the driving and the circumstances around the case, and that's the way the officers are trained in DUI detection and advanced DUI detection. So they are taught in methods for investigating. And again, I think we've got some gaps in the information, and we're not going to resolve that tonight. What I will be doing is meeting with Ben and Pete and Captain Hall and the officers that were on the scene and find out exactly what we do have, and I'll let counsel know in a follow-up report.
But let's keep in mind, it is very important that the officer, and it's been said many times, just because something happens doesn't automatically authorize a DUI examination, alcohol examination. There's got to be probable cause. You've got to see something on that person that causes you to think alcohol may be involved. The fact that there was a head-on collision isn't it. The fact that anything physically happens isn't it. It's all related to the smell of alcohol, the inability to walk, the inability to speak. Otherwise, the officer is going to be subject to suing for infringement of rights.
Well, I know you're a law enforcement type yourself. I appreciate that. But if I was driving along on Hitchcock Parkway and I crossed over with nobody coming ahead and there happened to be a policeman behind me, I think you'd probably stop me and say, am I feeling okay? This individual crossed over, hit another car. Isn't that Isn't that an indicator that you might want to get a book?
It certainly is, and we're going to have to wait till we get the result from the city manager looking into it.
I'm sorry, I just thought you said, you know, breathalyzed for weaving but not for hitting a car across the lane.
Just because it was a head-on, you don't get it. It could be a heart attack. It could be a medical condition.
It wasn't just a head-on. It was in the opposite lane.
I understand.
It's a difference.
But there still has to be probable cause to think that alcohol is involved.
I want to remind both of you gentlemen that alcohol is not the only thing that might cause one to veer off into the other lane. There's something called texting and trying to make a phone call while you're driving. I've had a lot of near misses from people who were sitting with the phone doing this and driving with their arms or whatever and coming into the lane. I've seen it on I-20. I've seen it on I-26. And so it's not just alcohol.
No, I agree. Not the intention.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've got a path forward on that, and we'll move on. We've got one other gentleman that would like to address council briefly. Okay. Claude O'Donovan. And
yes, Claude O'Donovan. I live at 159 Mallard Lake Drive, City of Aiken. Several months ago, when I read in the paper and rejoiced that South Carolina was, yes, getting another congressional district, and I thought, wow, and I think most of us probably said, well, hey, that's great, we're going to have seven. A chain reaction was set up that is going to affect this county, this city, greatly. We have elected a young man by a 71% margin in the primary runoff, Jeff Duncan, into a position that he is extremely well qualified for, more qualified than most any other congressman in our nation's capital, and that's in the field of energy. Even when he was a state legislator, had nothing to do with our county, he was making tours and guiding tours through SRS and getting himself educated on that energy. He has since brought our entire congressional contingency or group on a tour just several months ago. I've seen him in testimonies on the Hill in Washington where he educated the group there, on the committee, to the point that one of them said, I didn't even know SRS existed. And so we need that kind of representation here. The hearings are happening right now. You all know that. And I went to the testimonies locally. Nobody else showed up. There was like four of us that showed up. And this is critical, both for our Senate hearings and our House hearings. We were there. This is critical. I'm asking that you all at least write a letter to that committee, that House committee right now, letting them know that Aiken's doesn't want to take this line down. They've drawn the lines. You all know this, so that Joe Wilson will have the whole county. I have nothing against Joe, but Joe doesn't have the expertise that Jeff has, and we need that kind of expertise. It will affect us. So I'm asking you to do that, and then there will be Senate hearings. We probably need to do it again. I'm going there tomorrow to testify, my wife and I, and I think there's some others that are going to do it. But it'll be the next 3 days. If you can break loose and go over there, that would really be worthwhile. But the more times we can get Aiken mentioned into the record in those hearings, the better chance we have to at least have Jeff have some stake in Aiken County, some part of it. So I'm asking you to do that. I'll give you the address to write the letter if you're willing. And that is the House Judiciary Committee, South Carolina House of Representatives, P.O. Box 11867, Columbia, South Carolina, 29211. Please do that for our community. We need that.
The letters could be written to Tom Young, too, Representative Young.
Yes.
Who is a member of that committee.
Right. And I know you have written a letter, Mayor, and I appreciate that. And I really think it's critical that we get that in and we get it on the record with those folks, as they'll do a nexus search. And the more times Aiken is mentioned in these hearings, the higher priority it will get when the Senate reviews it. And maybe we can at least salvage part of that for him.
Who chairs that committee?
Say, what's that?
Who chairs the committee?
I'm sorry?
Who's the chair of the committee?
Who is the chair? It's
Who is it?
Jim Harris.
Jim Harris.
Thank you.
Clara, right. is it your understanding that if it proceeds as it's outlined right now, that Congressman Duncan would not get a spot on the Energy Committee?
No. What I'm saying is that he would not represent our county. You know, we need him representing our county. I will say one other thing. He has been promised the next seat in the next session on the Energy and Commerce Committee. And that's even going to make it even more powerful for us. So we need to somehow salvage some part of that. If you know, I know Joe Wilson's got to have the votes. He's been pushed out of the coast, and he's got to have that. But we need to at least keep some part of it in here. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. And sorry you had to wait through everything, but appreciate you with being with us. Okay, that's we need to vote, Council, on going into executive session.
So moved.
Mr. Mayor.
Legal matter. Just a minute. Let me finish, please. Legal matter. Aiken Community Playhouse request that we need some legal advice on. Now, excuse me.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay.
I was just going to echo what Mr. Donovan just said in terms of the benefits of us having two representatives. Isolating us to one will not cover the ground that we need, and that we need to represent, especially the issues with SRS, one of our prime contractors in the area. So if we could get letters out or
absolutely
attend the meetings to make some testimony, that would be great.
I wrote a letter, as Clark mentioned. It's an email today. I'll share that with anybody if you want to.
I've spoken several times to Congressman Young about it.
If anybody wants it, let me know, and I'll be glad to share it with you. Okay, I have a motion and a second.
So moved.
Second.
Second. Okay, show of hands, please. Okay, it's approved unanimously. Thank everyone for being here this evening.
She's
online now. Live action from the city council.
I tell you, I got
enough here.
No, Beverly
isn't.
What?
Me? Oh.
We have been into executive session to have legal matter discussed by attorney, the Aiken Community Playhouse request, and we're ready to come out of executive session now. Do we have a motion and a second?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Second.
Okay. Show of hands, please. Okay. All right. We're out of executive session.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, City Council.
And end of council.
So you don't have any information, is that right? You don't know why we went in, why we came out?
She doesn't care about that.
It's good to be back. That was a two-cut refresh.
Yeah.
Good
job. Yeah.
Well, see, that's why it was, because you're back.
When you go in.
Thank you, sir.